gentlemen. First case for argument, Scottsdale versus Village of Crestwood. Mr. Chemers.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, Robert Chemers for the defendants, appellants, the Village of Crestwood, Mayor Robert Stranzik, and for the purpose of this argument, former Mayor Chester Stranzik, who is also represented by Chris Dickinson of Jenner and Block at Council Table. This is an appeal from the Northern District of Illinois, sitting in diversity, unquestionably applying Illinois law. The policy interpretation case and only questions of law are presented to this Court for its de novo review. The Court will ascertain and give effect to the true intention of the contracting parties, and to do so, to look at the underlying complaints, compare those allegations to the provisions of the policy. In a duty-to-defend situation, if the facts fall within or even potentially within the policy scope, there is a duty to defend. A few years ago, a panel of this Court in the Del Monte case said, we begin with the deck stacked in favor of the insured. The Village of Crestwood and its mayors, past and present, are asking the Court for a new deal. The district court erred. The pollution exclusion does not apply. This is a case involving the sale of a product.
I don't understand that because, I mean, you could easily say it's also a case involving the redistribution of a very serious pollutant, these dry cleaning fluids. There's nothing, no one disputes that these materials are easily categorized as a pollutant, and the fact that one party distributes and then some other party redistributes it doesn't seem important.
That is correct, Your Honor. And there are two responses to that. The first one is the pollution exclusion that the Scottsdale policies have is overly broad, is not tied into premises, land, anything owned or maintained or occupied or used by the village.
But unlike, are you criticizing the contract you signed or what?
Well, the contract we signed is ambiguous, and it does not apply to this situation for two reasons. If you have a covered cause and an uncovered cause, and the covered cause is wholly independent of the uncovered or excluded cause, then there is a duty to defend.
But why is this wholly independent? Well, first of all, I'm not so sure that looking at the language of these insurance policies, this doesn't count as bodily injury arising, you know, from the actual alleged or threatened discharge, et cetera, of a pollutant.
So at any time.
We agreed that this is a pollutant, right?
We would agree it is a pollutant. However, where does it come from? Unlike the Chicago Housing Authority case this Court looked at, which tied the pollution into at or from land owned, occupied, maintained, leased, or rented to the insured. This is a completely different exclusion. This exclusion would say there is no coverage for spilling a can of Drano in the Jewel food store, which the Court in Pipefitter said is not the intent of the pollution exclusion. It's supposed to apply, according to the Supreme Court in Collins, to traditional environmental pollution.
But why isn't this traditional? I mean, you would agree, I'm sure, that if this had been a lawsuit against the dry cleaning company, then it would have been a traditional pollution situation, and they would have to buy separate insurance. The insurance industry doesn't want to underwrite these mammoth lawsuits.
That's correct. Exactly. Traditional environmental pollution, according to the Supreme Court in Collins, was something similar to Times Beach, Love Canal, and that's not what we have here. We have a situation here where, in fact, we pointed out to this Court, and we asked the Court to look at the September 15, 2011 decision of the Illinois Appellate Court, 3rd District, in the Erie insurance case, where the Court held the pollution exclusion doesn't apply or is ambiguous if applied to a situation where an insured, in the course of conducting its business, emits hazardous substances into the environment, but at a level within a permit given to the insured by the EPA.
Well, that's a different point. Now you're changing grounds on this here.
To respond to Your Honor's point, yes. And in the situation there, because the emissions were within the permit, the appellate court held the pollution exclusion was ambiguous. We have that same situation here.
While we're on that point, though, that theory seems to mean that coverage depends on whether you violated the law or not, in fact. And that seems a little curious to have insurance coverage depend upon the results of an investigation into the underlying facts, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, the policy is bought for the running of a municipality, which the business, part of the business of the municipality is water.
I'm talking about the Erie case, not this case.
The Erie case
seems to say, under your theory, that we don't know whether there's coverage until we have investigated, determined the contamination levels at all relevant times, and that seems like a very odd way to deal with insurance coverage.
Well, what the appellate court held was, determine if the application of the pollution exclusion is ambiguous. The trial court, according to the appellate court in Erie, did not need to determine if, based on the allegations of a complaint, there had been traditional environmental pollution. We have a situation here where we submitted to this court in the supplemental appendix the fact sheet from May of 2009 from the Illinois EPA, which says that at no time did the water distributed by the village ever exceed the maximum contaminant levels established by the EPA.
On what theory is that evidence properly before us?
The Erie case came down in September.
The fact sheet. Let's stick to the question. Under what theory is this fact sheet you're talking about properly before us? I can imagine that there are a lot of responses that the other side might want to make to that fact sheet if it had been introduced at a proper time.
Facts found on an agency website can be looked at by this court, even for the first time on appeal, where the facts are not in reasonable dispute.
Well, there Delnius
versus Dunlop.
Why are the facts not in reasonable dispute? I might say that the water, you know, according to a view of this case, the water officials of the town had been lying to the EPA at other times, so I don't know whether this fact sheet says something that's uncontestable or not.
Well, what the fact sheet says is that based on the investigation by the Illinois EPA to the date of the preparation of that fact sheet, May of 2009, the water levels at no time exceeded the MCLs.
That if a contaminant falls under this EPA rule, it's not actionable? It couldn't be tortious?
Answer
yes or no, please.
No, Your Honor.
So you admit, in other words, that even if the levels of pollutant were below the EPA threshold, there still might be a tort suit?
There might be an issue, yes, but that goes to the merits. It doesn't go to the duty to defend.
So I don't see why the Erie case helps you.
The Erie case helps from the standpoint that it's materially indistinguishable from this case if the court looks at the fact sheet from the EPA. It's indistinguishable because the levels of MCLs in the water in the village of Crestwood.
That's not beyond dispute, though, and I think what the Erie case does lead you toward is that this is a case about pollution, and thus you've got to deal, you know, with the section of the insurance agreements that creates an absolute pollution exclusion.
Well, it's questionable if that's an absolute pollution exclusion. It does.
Okay, look, what's the line that you want to draw? So give us an example of what you regard as pollution that would be within the exclusion.
Pollution within the exclusion would be contaminants that are not.
Example.
How about the dry cleaner here?
Well, the dry cleaner. If this policy was issued to the dry cleaner, then I would take the position that the pollution exclusion was correctly applied to exclude coverage for a tort claim. But as to the village, where there are multiple...
Wait a second. Would you slow down? Let's pursue the dry cleaner for a moment. Suppose the dry cleaner... the dry cleaner had spilled this contaminant because it had been supplied to him by a company which had warranted that it was absolutely non-polluting and that couldn't cause any harm. Now, would that get the dry cleaner off the hook?
No. It would not get the dry cleaner off the hook.
Well, then why does it matter that you were distributing, so to speak, a pollutant caused by someone else? What difference does that make?
That's but one theory of these cases. We're dealing with 22 policies of insurance.
Well, you're not answering my question. I mean, in most pollution cases, you can probably trace the pollution to some ultimate cause. So that you have some ultimate cause, then you have, I mean, you know, the Exxon Valdez, maybe that the boat was manufactured improperly, that's why it spilled and it wasn't Exxon's fault and so on. So typically you have someone who creates the contaminant, then you have someone who distributes it, right? And that's this case. And is it your view that the distributor is always outside the exclusion?
In this instance, yes, Your Honor. And
what about other instances? In all instances?
Well, in this instance, because
not this instance. I'm interested in what your rule is. So I'd like you to, if you want to say that the distributor of the contaminant is always outside the exclusion, fine, you can say that. But what is your position?
Well, the village here is not the cause of the pollution.
I gave you my examples.
It
often it's not the cause, right? Perfectly innocent. Right?
Correct. The village was not the polluter,
yes,
and no party.
I know. So is it your position that you're outside the exclusion if somehow you are an innocent distributor of pollutants? Even though you might be liable under tort law, you know,
but you're innocent.
Rylance versus Fletcher, yeah.
You know the pollutant is in there, but you're innocent.
Innocent but knowing or innocent but negligent. Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so the first sentence of the opinion you're writing says all entities who are innocent but negligent distributors of known pollutants do not fall within the pollution exclusion of contracts.
I would.
Your rule.
Yes, I would embrace that because, as this court knows, you can have multiple theories of recovery. All we need in the complaint is one.
That makes the exclusion totally empty. And also, I don't think what you understand is actually just suggested earlier, point by Judge Wood. The problem for the insurance companies is how do you make the actuarial calculation of what your liability is likely to be if you're liable for pollution, right? Because what insurance companies want to be able to do is to insure sort of repetitive, predictable misfortunes. And if the scope and incidence are totally unpredictable, then they can't figure out what the proper rate is, right? That's the problem. So on your theory about the innocent but knowing distributor of pollution, how do the insurance companies protect themselves?
The insurance company would protect itself by providing the coverage which its insured intended and thought it purchased. This was part of
no answer. I mean, that is a really bad answer, right?
I thought your better theory, if I could have a moment to indulge, I thought your better theory was simply that this is different because we are being sued as a product seller on a product liability theory.
That is correct. It's
a contaminated product. Right. No difference if it's in pipes or in bottles.
That's correct.
And my concern about that, in essence, is what limits are there to that kind of theory? And how do you deal with the literal language in the exclusion that refers to dispersal of contaminants?
Well, if the sale of water is dispersal of a product, then it would apply. We submit that it's not. That exclusion is ambiguous. And I see I'm
okay, well, thank
running
you,
out of time.
Mr. Chairman.
A few minutes for rebuttal, Your Honors.
Thank you.
And Daratani?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for hearing. Since I only have 2 minutes, I'll keep my statements relatively brief. Your Honor, I'm J. Paul Daratani, and I represent the 250 citizens of the class of the putative class residents. I want to answer the very specific question that Judge Wood brought up. Our underlying complaint which is the allegations are our underlying complaint, do not contain pollution. The citizens of Crestwood are not suing because the village polluted. The village, we would submit, did not pollute. And to answer the specific
but
question about...
But you are suing because the water had PERC in it, as I recall.
Your Honor, as defined by the EPA, it doesn't arise, IEPA, it does not arise to the level of pollution. And to answer Judge Posner's question and
crazy.
Judge Hammond's question, that may be the bar.
So why do you have a cause of action at all if the water was perfectly healthy?
Well, there's a difference between perfectly healthy. The chemicals in the water are carcinogens, and over time we allege they can cause cancer.
But they're not pollutants. They're not pollutants. They're merely.
So PCBs aren't pollutants either because.
Well, over the distribution and perhaps in the original setting, yes, but not here. Even in the redistribution, because it's of such a low. Level, but it is still a defective product that they should warn of with regard to that
but
defect.
The thing that makes it defective is the fact that there is this carcinogenic substance in the water.
Well, Your Honor, Judge Wood, if I could, what if they, by operation of their waterworks, mixed peanut oil, and then that caused those with peanut allergies in the village of Crestwood to become sick and ill? Obviously, peanut oil isn't a pollutant. So that
and
the,
thus the
fact
underlying
that
theory of that case might not fall within the pollution exclusion. But you're complaining about a pollutant.
I'm not.
I'm disturbed of in getting too far away from the facts of the case.
Well, our facts, and we would lose summary judgment, I submit, in the underlying case in Circuit Court of Cook County if we alleged pollution because it didn't arise to the legal definition, the legal standard of what the IEPA
no,
is
I
called
think
pollution.
I think you're confusing two things. There are pollutants, but then there's a separate question, how dangerous it is to have a particular level of pollution, right?
Well, Judge Posner,
you can name any pollutant you want. If the pollutant is sufficiently diluted, it's not going to hurt anybody, but there's still pollution.
It wouldn't be classified as pollution.
No,
it may be classified
as
a carcinogen.
Now this is semantic nonsense. You have pollutants, but if they're not in a very great, I mean, suppose you have fecal matter in drinking water. That's a pollutant, right?
I would submit.
But if it's sufficiently diluted, it's totally harmless.
Well, it actually can be quite harmful, even if it is diluted.
No. Look, you're just changing my example. There is a level of dilution at which the most horrible pollutants are harmless.
True.
Right? And but they're still pollutants. There's still polluted water, but it's not dangerous.
Judge
so
Posner,
you don't do anything about it.
The water you're drinking probably contains a certain level of pollutants. We could call that, in my view, would be, and what I think the Erie case was saying, it's such a broad definition that was attempted to be used. Your water
is
not pollution.
At the end of the day, your clients believe, I'm sure genuinely, that they have been injured by whatever the level was of the PERC that managed to make it through into this water because of the ground dispersal and the use of the well water and the whole underlying story. So their theory is not separable from the fact that this dangerous substance made its way into the water supply through the conscious actions, that's your theory, of the village.
I would respectfully disagree because it's only the mechanism of injury. It doesn't matter whether it's peanut oil or milk or fecal matter, a non-pollutant or a pollutant. It is when it's a carcinogen or it causes harm to them, it doesn't matter to those residents how they were harmed.
Well,
it matters that they were harmed.
It would just be a failure to disclose case anyway.
And that is a substantial part of our case.
Let's stick to these facts, at least to this pollutant. If I understand your position, it would be the same whether the chemicals were introduced deliberately as a criminal act by an employee of the city or by somebody who broke into the plant and decided to cause harm to individuals, right?
Essentially, yeah.
You don't care how it got into the water supply,
exactly,
do you?
Exactly, Tom. In the sense that it goes in the sense that it reached below that level, and under our definition in Illinois, we don't call that a pollutant.
That's a different problem, and that's not going to work. Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Dilettani. Dilettani, sorry. Mr. Jones?
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Bradley Jones, here representing plaintiffs Scottsdale Indemnity and National Casualty Company. I come to you from dry Minneapolis to wet, snowy, and cold Chicago. I would submit that this case is a Chicago Housing Authority case. The distributor, in this case, the Village.
Draw the line. Right, so... So what about Mr. Dilettani's peanut oil example?
Well, we have to look back to the language of the exclusion.
No, I mean, his peanut oil example tells you that they're just complaining that they got water that hurt them. It hurt them in this instance because of what was in the well water, but it could have been peanut oil. It could have been, you know, runoff from a pig farm. It could have been... any number of things. And we're stuck, I think, under the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Columns with this line-drawing problem. Whatever we said in CHA may or may not have any bearing on it. This is Illinois law.
Well, Columns, of course, sets the standard because it tells us that the pollution exclusion must apply to traditional environmental contamination.
And worries about extending it to ordinary torts, because, you know, people are thinking that they're paying for something when they buy an insurance policy, and they think they're getting coverage that an ordinary person would think is there. And why isn't product liability just an ordinary tort?
I think the Columns Court had an opportunity to comment on whether reasonable expectations should be expanded beyond the scope of automobile policies in Illinois to other types of coverage, and it didn't do that.
So reasonable expectations don't matter?
Not according to the law of Illinois outside of the automobile insurance spectrum.
I don't think that's necessarily a good reading of Columns, because maybe the court didn't quite use that language, but it says we're worried about the breadth of the absolute pollution exclusion, so-called. We're going to say it covers traditional environmental pollution. We're worried about expanding it to ordinary torts and thus becoming, quote, so general as to be meaningless. So I take from that language that they think they're drawing some lines. And they don't want it to be so general as to be meaningless.
And I agree. And if this were a situation involving peanut oil, I don't think peanut oil is a pollutant.
Well, let's talk about something that you would agree is a pollutant. I take it from your position, Mr. Jones, that if something called traditional environmental pollution is a but-for cause anywhere along the line, as a matter of fact, then the pollution exclusion applies. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Okay. Oh, I don't think you can take that position. That's not going to work. I mean, suppose some malicious kitchen worker drops PCBs into a glass of water for an obnoxious customer. Would a suit against the restaurant be barred by the pollution exclusion?
Well, the exclusion says
answer yes or no, please.
The answer is yes, because the pollution exclusion talks about arising out of. And so as long as the incident that's at issue arises out of, and even if there is this malicious conduct, the pollution exclusion would apply.
Well, I don't think that's right.
Let's try something else.
Unreasonable.
Luckily, we don't have to go there in this case.
Luckily. That can't be right.
Well, let's try something else. Oil tank truck driving down the highway has a loose valve. Drips oil all over the highway. That sounds like pollution, right?
It does.
The truck driver follows it, hits the oil slick, skids out of control, and hits some other cars. Is the business that owns the truck that went out of control, entitled to CGL coverage, would the exclusion apply in that case?
I doubt that the exclusion would apply.
Why
because
not?
We don't have traditional environmental contamination.
But you thought it was in my glass of water case.
But it was a but-for cause.
You just said it was a pollutant. There was pollution dispersed into the environment when the truck drives down the road and leaks oil all over it.
Well, then I'll reconsider my position and say that in your example, your earlier example, there was no traditional environmental contamination involving the intentional introduction of some kind of pollutant into this restaurant's food.
So let's go back to the oil truck.
Yep.
Negligent, leaky valve.
Yep.
Lots of pollution occurs by negligence. Why isn't that traditional environmental pollution?
Because it's not all-encompassing contamination of water, groundwater, water,
that's not what the
air.
Well,
if that's where you're going, let's try a little differently. Suppose we had a defendant in these underlying cases that didn't distribute its water by pipes, but distributed it by bottles. Maybe it's Evian, maybe it's Perrier. Pick your favorite brand. And the spring is polluted somehow, and they wind up distributing bottled water that hurts their consumers. Is that excluded?
I think it's the same as this case.
Okay.
And this is based on the assumption that the water was contaminated, that mm-hmm. the seller, the distributor, then put in bottles and distributed.
What if in the oil case, Judge Hamilton's case, what if the oil is leaked into a waterway, and it contaminates it and it kills fish and so on, but suppose also because there's so much oil in the water, there's a fire, and some boat is consumed by the fire. Would that also be within the pollution exclusion at that accident?
It could be if there was endemic sort of contamination of this waterway with oil spread all across. It's like Lake Erie was on fire back in 1970.
Exactly.
It might well.
Cuyahoga River.
Yes.
Yeah, the Cuyahoga
Just
River. That would probably fall within the purview of this exclusion.
Of course, the insurance company's concern is with massive liability, primarily, you know, the cleaning up costs, the circle costs. And in a case where there's just, in Judge Hamilton's case or my case, the glass of water, what have you, where there's just an isolated accident, the concerns behind the exclusion are not really engaged anymore.
I think that's what the Illinois Supreme Court has said also.
I'm troubled, frankly, Mr. Jones, by the idea. And I'm looking at this, in essence, as a product liability claim. Okay, and what you seem to be saying is that for sellers of products, whether they're municipal governments or privately owned public utilities or a distributor of fish that's contaminated by mercury or something like that, that there's this really big exclusion that would apply as a matter of fact if the insurer can at some point show as a factual matter there was this stuff called pollution that occurred somewhere in the causal chain. That seems like a pretty massive exception for product liability coverage.
The exclusion, the pollution exclusion, would then trump the product's liability coverage in a circumstance where there is traditional environmental contamination. This set of facts here is just that.
I think that the concern that we're all trying to explore is if the reason that the product is defective, the alleged reason, has anything to do along the chain with the fact that something that could be characterized as traditional pollution has become part of the product, whether it's a fish absorbing mercury or whether it's, you know, Evian's water with perk in it or whether it's any other sort of thing. You know, somebody decides to sell clothes that they've bleached with a substance that turns out to irritate the skin badly and the bleach would be a pollutant. I mean, it's very hard to draw any kind of rational line, whereas you can draw a line if you say the pollution exclusion is not about product liability claims. The pollution exclusion is about cleaning up the environment and also compensating for the costs of bodily injury that result from environmental pollution, breathing bad air, drinking the water, what have you. So I guess, you know, I don't know how you integrate the product liability theories into this exclusion.
I think Collins has tried to tell us how to do that by looking to see whether there is traditional environmental contamination. And if there is, there's an exclusion.
Well, I don't like that traditional environment. What do other states do? Do they talk about traditional environmental?
There are other states that hold that the exclusion applies only in the context of traditional environmental contamination.
They use that that term, traditional environmental.
Of course, Collins says the exclusion doesn't apply because this CO stays inside the building, right?
Sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
In Collins, they held ultimately that the exclusion did not apply.
Did not apply.
Right.
That's right, because it wasn't, in their view, the type of contamination.
So it was certainly a pollutant, but because it stays inside the building, it's not environmental contamination.
Apparently, that's what they're saying. That's right.
Okay.
No, there was a case from the Illinois Court of Appeals a little while ago involving the vandals who came and set fire to cardboard. And the insured had nothing to do with causing the fire. The insured had lots of cardboard, which caused a huge fire and all kinds of problems for the surrounding community breathing this atmosphere. And the result was that the pollution exclusion would apply despite the fact that these vandals came and actually were the direct cause of the pollution. And I think that under the reasoning in that case, as the reasoning in the Chicago Housing Authority case, this is why the insurers have taken the position they have in this case, that there should be no coverage. Our position is...
Mr. Jones, let me just ask you. Suppose these complaints say nothing at all about the cause of the contamination of the water. And so the insurer is tendered the claims, and you don't know what the cause was. Does the coverage, does the exception, the exclusion apply?
It would be difficult to apply that where there's a duty of defense question. I don't think the insurer would be well advised to deny coverage based on the exclusion unless there are allegations that pollutants, and under the context of Illinois law, traditional environmental contamination, caused the injuries.
So if there's a problem here, it's because the underlying complaints said more than they needed to, right?
I'm not sure they said more than they needed to.
Well?
The plaintiff's lawyers might beg to disagree.
Well, there are a lot of complaints. I confess I haven't read them all yet. But if what you just told me is right, I mean, all you have to allege on the product, for a product liability suit, you don't have to allege the mechanism by which the contamination occurred. You just have to say you sold me crummy water, contaminated water, right? And you're saying that would be covered, at least as to a duty to defend.
Well, if it says contaminated water, then we'd have to look at the complaint. But conceptually...
Suppose the complaint says nothing more.
Then I think the insurer would probably wind up defending, unless there were allegations.
And the underlying question of indemnity would depend upon the factual inquiry about exactly how the contamination occurred.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. Our arguments are... I think, exhaustively set forth in our brief. We did raise another basis upon which to grant summary judgment, the failure to supply exclusion.
What function does the word pure play, then, in the statute that's being talked about there?
I'm sorry,
the language about the other parties are saying that renders some of your theory would render some of that language superfluous, and I'm just curious about your response to that.
Well, I think that by use of the word adequately encompasses concepts not only of quantity but quality. And if we look, and therefore purity would come within the quality aspect of that. If you look at the other types of products that are involved in that exclusion, oil, water, electricity, and steam, each of those has a concept of quality built in as well.
I thought that was at least ambiguous. It seemed to me the more rational way to read that failure to supply was, you know, if you turned off the spigot, basically, which would be the same with electricity or with gas or with any other utility. So maybe, you know, it's not enough to say one could read it your way. I think one has to say one has to read it your way.
I agree. One has to read the word adequately to encompass what adequately means. And it's played in ordinary use. I see I've got my red light.
Okay.
Any further
questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
We'll have to move on.
All right.
So, Mr. Chairman, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you have anything further.
Judge Hamilton, in response to a question that you posed to Mr. Jones, asking him if the village sold contaminated water, would there be a duty to defend? He said there would. That, to me, is grounds enough for this court to reverse. Judge Wood, you posed the question.
That actually wasn't what he said. I don't know what you're saying.
You posed the question.
He said if there was no mention of contamination in the complaint, just people having gotten ill because of the sale of a defective product, then he said there would be a duty to defend.
Correct. And I think one of the questions that Judge Hamilton asked was if the village sold crummy water, I think was his word. And he said there would be a duty to defend. The duty to defend is very broad. The threshold is very low. Judge Wood, in response to the question about the failure to supply exclusion, it is unquestionably ambiguous. I don't think the Crestwood Fire Department is concerned when they're fighting a fire that the water is pure. They're concerned that it's enough. It's quality and quantity, and you don't know which word is being used here. This is not a CHA case. This is completely different than CHA with a vastly different exclusion. This is also vastly different than the exclusion in Collins, which talked about the contamination into the air, water, ground, and environment, which is why the Supreme Court did not find the pollution exclusion to apply, because the contaminants, which arguably were pollutants, never left a building. People were injured by inhaling fumes from a leaking furnace inside a building. It didn't go into the environment, which is why the court found the exclusion ambiguous and not traditional environmental pollution. The sale of defective water or contaminated water, we submit, is not traditional environmental pollution. We ask this court to reverse.
Okay, well, thank you very much to all counsel. Next case for argument.